Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Alexander Hemon, Sasha Hemon. The book is The Making of Zombie Wars. It's a very radical departure from his previous work. Do you have a way of describing the tone of this book?
It's a comic novel. There is also a roller coaster ride of violence and sex.
Well, that's being very good, but it's also about what happened to America in a certain way when schlock took over and bad taste replaced literature and, you know, a certain kind of commercial junk movie replaced movies as an art form. And so it's a really American nihilistic nightmare. Yes or no?
Well, it also takes place at the time of the Iraq invasion when there was a corresponding collapse of clear thinking. One of the fascinating things about American culture is how anxieties and fantasies and fears and projections play themselves out in popular culture, in popular art forms, rather, like movies or comic books and so on. So that, you know, the zombie movies could be interpreted in any number of ways, but they always correspond to some fear in the American population about, you know, impeding invasion or impeding takeover by masses of others. There was a case in the 60s when, you know, that those fears were formulated, and rather brilliantly, I have to say, in George Romero's movies, although some of them were in the 70s, particularly Night of the Living Dead. And the resurgence, the renaissance of zombie discourse in the past 10, 15 years is, you know, feeding, I bet, a large number of PhD theses.
Yes, yes. But I must tell you that when I was young, if the phrase zombie discourse arose, people would have laughed. Zombie discourse. Well, you know, we have it now for sure, zombie discourse. But not perhaps to our credit, yes or no?
Well, I mean, it's a fact of American cultural life. It's not my preferred way to deal with anxieties and fears and, you know, the disgrace that the Bush years and the Iraq invasion were and still are in many ways. I think art and literature have the capability of confronting such questions and issues face on rather than, you know, packaging them into some kind of entertainment for consumption, and then the residue of that consumption might bring up some important questions. But, you know, it is a fact of American life, and it has to be dealt with as such. We cannot simply ignore it. I couldn't ignore it, I don't think. Mm-hmm. There's this collective we. There's something to be said about, craze of superhero movies that, again, there was a resurgence after 2001 and then 2003, where this whole notion of American superpower and then the subsequent failure of imposing that superpower on the world was lived through. And so the superheroes do what the superpower can't anymore.
Yes, it's a dream of a lost superpower. The Making of Zombie Wars has as its central character a young, well, what is he, 30-something?
Yeah, mid-30s.
Named Joshua Levin, who is part of a vast mass deception among his deceptions that a person could be a screenwriter while living in Chicago.
Or that, living anywhere, for that matter. It's like one of the great American dreams.
Yes, yes. But, you know, in Los Angeles, where this show is taped, everyone laughs and says, of course, you have to come here. You know, you have to work where the work is. It's not always true that you can write this at home and expect the whole rest of the fantasy, the agent, the movie star, the producer. And so what we discover in the making of Zombie Wars is that Chicago, of all places, has pseudo-agents and screenwriting continuing ed classes that meet in people's homes. And they discuss movies, which in this case means from time to time they mention The Searchers.
Right.
The only movie that Americans are sure they can take seriously. And it's kind of a nihilistic nightmare novel, it seems to me, as much as it's a comic novel.
Well, there's a conversion of despair into comedy, which I was, an anger that comes with the despair that I was trying to do there. For many years, I've loved Gary Steingart's work, and his earlier novels were all hilariously intense comic novels. But I always thought there was the source of that comedy was some kind of anger, and of course that came through in Little Failure, and so which is a brilliant book in its own right. And so what I wanted to do is to sort of inverse the process. I wanted to see if my anger and despair related to the disgrace of the Bush years and thereafter could be converted in comedy, and then intensify this to the point where the intensity sends its own signals, as it were.
Joshua has, several hundred ideas for films whose premises, you know, because you're taught when pitching that you should be able to say what your movie is about in one line, and preferably less. And he has come upon the notion of zombie wars. It's, by comparison, his art film. And because he's writing D.W. Griffith style, virtually without dialogue, scenes, patchworks of horror that don't require that he become a writer of cause and effect. Cause and effect is taken here to be not just a writing practice, but a moral practice too, that an action should have consequences, not in Josh's life and not in Josh's screenplays, but here he's made a kind of Guernica of zombies.
That's funny. The Guernica of zombies. Well, the interesting thing for me was the challenge, the formal challenge, as it were, was how to have a character who has trouble with agency, personal and moral and otherwise, and yet have this character who can carry a novel and can also, you know, find a way in which he would deal with the fact that his agency is limited, to say the least. And in the light of what we had talked about earlier, his agency is played out in the script. He identifies with Major K, which is, you know, a variation on the classic American John Wayne-ish hero who just moves through adverse circumstances and conquers them by way of sheer will. And to him, agency comes naturally as breathing, whereas Joshua has an entirely different approach to agency. And I wanted this tension, the fantasy of agency equaling agency, to see how that would work in a comic context, in a context of a plot in a novel.
I'm talking to Sasha Hemon about his novel, The Making of Zombie Wars, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's a very interesting novel. It poses the question, can a well-written novel be written about a bad writer. I'm curious. The dominant philosopher seems to be Spinoza. Why is that?
Spinoza is fascinating in many ways. He was the first secular Jew, arguably, because he was excommunicated from the religious community. But he was also, you know, one of the bright lights in the Enlightenment movement, someone who believed in reason and order in the world and the ability of human beings to understand what's going on and then control it by way of reason. And so Joshua starts out admiring Spinoza, but as the book develops, he's quoting more and more and more the scriptures and sort of the messianic messages and asking the Lord to help in the reason retreating in disarray for him. Spinoza is also, I mean, in the history of philosophy, he's one of those philosophers with integrity. They're heroic philosophers, and there, you know, there's Heidegger, and he's one of those heroic philosophers who defended his system of beliefs in under assault from all sides. And this kind of intellectual integrity, moral integrity, is something that is not available to Joshua, but more importantly, was not available in this country pretty much during the Bush years.
And we've got a lead character here, Joshua Levin, who, although he would like to think of himself as a nice guy, he's incapable of moral decisions.
Well, that was a fascinating thing to me. It's easy now to see how, you know, the hawks and warmongers and sort of, you know, deluded patriots were rushing into the war. But in the early aughts, at around the time of the Iraq War, Bush had about 91% support, I remember, one survey. How did we all get excited about that? And all these decent people, what we would now call liberals, suddenly there was this madness, this passionate desire to go and invade countries without thinking, without considering basic and obvious facts. And to me, this loss of consciousness on the part of someone who's Joshua, who's a relatively privileged pseudo-liberal, or not pseudo-liberal, but neoliberal family with some kind of societal values and all this interest in art and you know, living in the city and whatnot, all whatever it seems that would be a kind of thing that would prevent him from rushing headlong into catastrophe. How does he get involved in such projects, losing his mind along the way? But there was also a mass transference of agency onto a presumably heroic character, the Bush with testicles on the aircraft carrier, you know, during the Mission Impossible pageant. And it was staged so perfectly that this masculine agency that the Bush administration and Bush in his deluded mind projected was absorbing the agency from many of us, right? We wanted revenge, and we sent him to handle that. He was a decider, and then he sent our boys and girls to screw up Iraq, and they did quite well doing that.
And so it's becomes, I think, an extremely dark book. I did think it masquerades very well as a comedy. Zombies, screenwriting, you know, a sexual triangle. But eventually we see that none of these characters is able to climb out of the rut they're in.
Well, I think that the heart of every great comedy, unless you're repeating the already familiar joke, there is something dark or something that is frightening in its transformative possibilities. Or you can say that, you know, the other side of every joke is fear of death. But there's also, that's one way to look at it. And the other way to put it really is that you tell funny things if you survive, and as long as you can tell jokes or stories about what has just happened, you keep living. It's the Decameron thing, surrounded by the plague, people sit around, and the Bogacha thing. I'm mispronouncing this.
Decameron.
You know, they sit besieged by the plague, and they tell stories about that are funny and full of desire and sex, the stories of life. As long as they keep telling the story, that means that the plague is outside. And this is a fascinating process or transference of anger and despair into comedy. That's the kind of comedy I like. That's the kind of comedy the Bosnians like, and people from other worlds, rather than, you know, a comedy that already confirms what you think about the world, the comedy that makes you laugh because it is invested with confirmation bias, the comedy of stereotypes and the comedy of, comfort.
Now, there's a sudden change in the last two chapters of the book. So far, we've been reading chapters about the zombies, followed by chapters about Josh and his family and friends. But suddenly, at the end of the book, at a Seder, at a Passover service, this is taking the place of the zombie chapter, and the zombies end the book. In other words, they've won. I think the reader wants to say, how did you dare do this? It's a really brave book in its willingness to be repellent.
I always wanted to end the book that way, with inversion, because what was, a fantasy in form of a script for Joshua suddenly becomes a reality, or at least a higher reality, as opposed to what his everyday life has been.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Alexander Hemon about his book, The Making of Zombie Wars. We'll continue after this short break.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Alexander Hemon about his recent book, The Making of Zombie Wars. It's funny, it's sexy, it's violent, but it's also horrifying on several different levels. And I want to open our next section by talking about bad taste. Because in a certain way, once upon a time, the image, the icon for bad taste was pink flamingos, both as an object on people's lawns and as a film. Eventually, we get vampires and then zombies. In this book, zombies are, they eat flesh. They're the essence of what bad taste involves. They eat things that rot inside them, and when they are torn open, the stink of the consumed flesh is the fetor of this novel. I found myself wondering, when life becomes this awful, how does something like a novel stay valid or alive? Is it forced into a oppositional relationship to culture?
Well, I don't know. I think novel is a tool of investigation in a culture. At least it ought to be. That's how I think of it. It opens up, at least it could be. It opens up new paths into new futures and new experiences. I like to write about what I don't know yet and use the writing process to figure out how certain things work. I don't know the answers before I start. What novels do, what literature does, it formulates difficult, complicated, extensive questions about human life now and ever. And in that formulation, it opens up the possibility of answers. It doesn't necessarily provide answers, otherwise it's propaganda.
I've read many novels in which I dislike the protagonist. I don't necessarily like Humbert Humbert, say, in Lolita, but I love the novel in which he appears. This Joshua seems to be such a nothing, such a nebbish, such a person whose values come from the bad faith of the Bush years. It couldn't have been pleasant to write about him.
Well, he was, because he was funny. I like to think of him as funny, and there's this to write, you don't have to like your characters, obviously, but you have to love them the way you might love a pet or a feeble cousin, a feeble-minded cousin, or the worst parts of yourself, because, you know, there are tendencies in me that I exaggerated to infest Joshua with them. And the tendencies that are not just mine, matter of my psychology, but something that emerged in me and during the Bush years, the kind of the anger, the hatred, the passivity, the despair, the unchecked desire, and so on. And to me, when writing a novel, I imagine, this is how it works for me, I am every character in the novel, and each character corresponds to some aspect of me, but then that aspect is taken to its logical extreme. And so in some ways, it allows me to expand my moral field for examination, my own, and then by extension, the readers or whoever's interested in that. So the Joshua then expresses some of my worst tendencies, but at the same time, they're not just mine. One of the things that I want to address is this particular form of male entitlement that has a history in the United States and has been present in writing literature and most recently in Mad Men, that, you know, that the way to stave off. In fact, David Foster Wallace, in the review of one of the later John Updike books, talks about Updike's bizarre idea that a way to stave off existential despair is by having sex with whomever you want, whenever you want. And this, it also corresponds to, you know, this need in American power structures to exert and impose this collective masculinity of America. And I wanted that masculinity to some extent I possess being a man. But I infested Joshua with that and pushed him in the direction of the logical extreme.
Okay, Sasha. But first of all, is it an American trait? Certainly the machismo of Latin men is a version of that. The men that Flaubert writes about in Madame Bovary victimize her and victimize her fantasies. They're also male chauvinist aristocratic pigs. We have watched this in every culture. Do you think it's a characteristic of the man?
Well, I think there's something to be said about that, that, you know, the cultures for many centuries were formulated around, you know, male entitlement, most obviously. But here, it becomes a matter of policy and politics, and up to this point. And it's, you know, there's been a backlash against opposition to that kind of entitlement in so many ways. And you see it in Washington, you see it in literature, you see it on television. Mad Men could be understood in that sense, you know, reinvigorating the male entitlement narrative. And also, you know, we can argue about individual works of art, but whatever the machismo of Latin men might be, they do not invade countries to show that they have the biggest penis in the world. And this is a particular privilege of the American military system.
There was George Bush pretending to be a bewildered little boy. He had nothing of the threat of Latin American dictators who may not have been invading other countries. They were murdering their citizenship. We haven't yet really gotten around to that except in the obvious ways we're exploring right now, what's happening to black citizens in America. And, you know, it is the future. It will be, if successful, the way in which the North American continent imitates the South American one.
The aspect of Latin American dictatorships was that they did not need an endorsement of the people. They forced them into obedience, and the relationships between power and citizenship and citizenry here is somewhat different. And for one thing, the citizenry can write novels and object to the way some of those tendencies become manifest. And that's what I was trying to do.
Yes, I agree with you. And yet, I would like to say that one of the ways in which globally the citizenry, the importance of novels, is that they keep coming from people who are busily telling the truth, dramatically, comically, demonstrably black. That we're, you know, we really did. We watched the invention of a form that went from psychological truth to a form of very bleak satire. It's absolutely necessary, but it's to be found now everywhere in the world. There is not a country that doesn't have its own Kafka novel. We have picked up the despair of the greatest novels of our time and made them global.
Well, that's an interesting proposition. I think that, you know, novel and writing novels is not a finished project. And so inquiries, or the focus of those inquiries, the foci, they move, they change. What has happened in this country over the past, you know, 10, 15 years? It's traumatic to me to this day. It is, one finds a way to formulate one's thoughts in a narrative way, and this is what novels do. It is not the best time in the history of the world right now, here or anywhere else.
And one of the signs, at least here, is that our disinclination to read novels, the claims being made by intellectuals that not even intellectuals read them. It's a very frightening thing, because this is the way that we're used to spreading the news of the horror that surrounds us. The sign that we've gone beyond anger and despair is our refusal to read novels.
Well, some people still do, and I think our refusal to read novels exactly corresponds, and in fact might be the same thing, with our refusal to confront the inconvenient facts of a changing world and our own moral culpability in what our government has done in our name. And so novels are read. I think there are more readers now reading novels than ever before, but those are escapist novels more than ever before. They are used and read so as to forget what we need to remember.
I've been speaking with Alexander Hemon, author of The Making of Zombie Wars, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. If I have suggested that the book is full of provoked, complicated emotions in me, I mean only by that to say that it's a good book. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Making of Zombie Wars at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. A bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Next time on Bookworm, we have Wendela Vida.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.